Representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban meet in Doha for a second day in a row as the militant group steps up its offensive across Afghanistan. Iran slams as outrageous the U.S.'s denial of an agreed deal on a humanitarian prisoner swap, saying Tehran is ready to proceed. And Indonesia registers a record number of physician deaths from the coronavirus in the first half of July as the country is struggling to slow the virus's transmission. I'm Marcia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. First story takes us to Doha, where the second day of talks between representatives of the Afghan government and the Taliban has begun in the Qatari capital, Doha. The head of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, Abdullah Abdullah, and former President Hamid Karzai are in attendance. Now, the new round of talks has raised hopes that lasting peace can be achieved in Afghanistan. For months, the government and the Taliban have been meeting on and off in Doha without any major breakthrough. Negotiations come as the militants have stepped up their attacks in different parts of Afghanistan, seizing vast parts of the territory. Meanwhile, Taliban top official Hibatullah Akhundzadeh says he is strenuously favoring a political settlement despite the group's gains. Crossing over to Kabul, joined by Pramin Alani. I mean, thanks so much for being with us. Well, tell us what's going on and the analysis from that side of things.
Well, Marcia, both sides, the negotiating teams of the Afghan government and the Taliban, who are currently in the Qatari capital, Doha, are optimistic about the results of the negotiations in order to lead the country into a lasting peace and stability. According to a member of the Afghan negotiating team, both sides are arguing about formation of three separate committees to discuss key issues regarding to the fate of the country. One of those issues is discussing the Afghan constitution. The second one is formation of a new government. And the third one is the release of Taliban prisoners, as well as the removal of the names of Taliban's leadership from the UN blacklist. In the meantime, here in Afghanistan, it seems that the Afghan government is not very much optimistic about the results of the possible result of this round of intra-Afghan talks in Doha, because Shah Hussein Murtazawi, one of the advisors to President Ghani, has said that the Taliban is not behaving in accordance to the interests of Afghanistan. And he added that given there is no even a single woman in the negotiating team of the Taliban military group, it proves that the Taliban still thinks about their own Islamic Emirate that they want to establish it once again in Afghanistan. In the meantime, top politicians, including Afghan President Mohammad Ashraf Ghani, have repeatedly stressed that there is no win via military options in Afghanistan, and that the people of Afghanistan are tolerating the are paying the price for rising insecurity and bloodshed in this country. Abdullah Abdullah, who is the head of National Council for High Council for National Reconciliation, also said before his departure to Doha, he said that the main loser of this ongoing war and bloodshed in Afghanistan is, of course, the people of Afghanistan. He stressed that the only way is to make an agreement to lead Afghanistan to peace and stability and prosperity. But in the meantime, let's not forget that many here also believe that given the Taliban has in recent months gained more territories in Afghanistan, the group will most possibly puts pressure on the Afghan government negotiating team in order to accept its demands. That is, of course, rejection of the Afghan constitution, as or at least to review this constitution. Despite the Taliban has repeatedly said that we are supporting some other issues like freedom of speech, press freedom, as well as women's rights, but Menaher also say that there is need for the Afghan government to seriously talk to the Taliban negotiator team members in order to give a guarantee regarding to this issue if there is a possible new government in Afghanistan after the this round of intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha. As the talks are underway in Doha between the two sides, two negotiating teams of the Afghan government and the Taliban, fightings are also underway between both sides inside Afghanistan. Afghan government sources say that at least five districts have been liberated from Taliban over the past 2 days. In the meantime, Taliban are also claiming that they have captured some new districts, mainly in northern Faryab province of Afghanistan. Currently, fierce fightings are underway in the suburbs of Talikan in northern Tahar province of Afghanistan. Local sources there say that the Taliban militants have attacked the city from three directions, and that Afghan security forces, as well as local commanders who are leading the public uprising forces, are strongly resisting the Taliban militants, and they have even pushed back the Taliban from some areas very close to the Talikan, that is the capital city of northern Tahar province.
All right, thank you so much for that update. Of course, we're keeping our eyes on those latest talks in Doha. That's Amin Alami reporting for us out of Kabul. Iran's foreign ministry has hit back at the U.S. after it denied an agreement, also involving the U.K. to swap 10 prisoners on all sides. Ministry spokesman Saeed Khatibzadeh stressed that the existence of the deal and even an agreement on how to announce it are simple facts. He said the U.S. is denying the matter is outrageous. Khatibzadeh said the humanitarian swap was agreed in Vienna, but separate from the nuclear talks. He said Iran is ready to proceed today. Earlier, Iran's top negotiator at the Vienna talks said the prisoner exchange could take place on Sunday. But the spokesman for the U.S. State Department denied any deal outside of the framework of the nuclear talks. Ned Price claimed that the prisoner swap is held up by the delay in the nuclear talks. He also accused Iran of an outrageous effort to deflect blame for the impasse at the negotiations. The annual Hajj pilgrimage has begun in Mecca, with tens of thousands of Muslims residing in Saudi Arabia amid the coronavirus pandemic. Saudi authorities have chosen only 60,000 fully vaccinated residents through a lottery to take part in the second downsized Hajj pilgrimage. The number is far below one of the world's largest annual religious gatherings, which saw some 2.5 million people attending the ceremony before the pandemic in 2019. Pictures coming out of the Grand Mosque in Mecca show pilgrims circling Islam's holiest site in mass and on distant paths. The five-day Hajj reaches its peak on Tuesday, which marks the Eid al-Adha, or the Feast of Sacrifice. Well, Turkey has condemned a ruling by the top European Union court allowing companies to ban employees wearing headscarves under certain conditions. Ankara slammed the verdict as a clear violation of religious freedom, adding that the move would exacerbate prejudices against Muslim women in Europe. The Turkish Foreign Ministry said the ruling was a sign of rising Islamophobia at a time when Muslim women in Europe are being subjected to increasing discrimination for their religious beliefs. The Luxembourg-based EU Court of Justice ruled on Thursday that employers may ban the wearing of visible symbols of religious or political belief, such as headscarves. It added, however, in its ruling that respective courts in the bloc's 27 member states should consider whether the ban corresponds to a genuine need on the part of employers.
Shh.
shock has rippled through the Muslim community after the European Union's highest court ruled that businesses can sack Muslim women for wearing the hijab if they work face-to-face with customers or if the wearing of the religious clothing causes workspace conflicts. The ruling was in response to a case brought by two German Muslim female workers who were asked by their employers not to wear Islamic headscarves while at work.
The decision has been met by claims that it will further fuel Islamophobia at this crucial time when countries in Europe such as France and Austria are already eliminating freedoms for Muslims, supposedly to combat extremism.
In Britain, several religious MPs, including Muslims and a Sikh, chastised the court, labelling the ruling as Islamophobic and deeply flawed. In addition, I spoke with a London-based female Muslim media personality about her fears for the future of Muslims in Europe.
To me, I feel oppressed, to be honest, by this decision. And I feel that I am now limited in my identity and my freedom of rights, freedom of belief, all the values that are actually supposedly meant to be Western, modern. Yes, part of it is a symbol of my faith, but it's so much more if you were to really understand what the hijab actually means or any sort of religious symbol. It is not just coming from one aspect. I think it's really unfair. And it's, again, it is targeting a particular group, especially the Muslim women, because we are the ones that are known to be wearing the headscarf known as the hijab.
Many activists warned that following the niqab ban, European powers would target the hijab next. They were right. But if the battle to protect the hijab is lost, what comes next? Robert Carter, London.
Indonesia has registered a record number of physician deaths from the coronavirus in the first half of the month of July. Health officials say 114 doctors died from the virus during that mentioned period. Now, that accounts for 20% of all such deaths in Indonesia since the pandemic began. The country has registered more new COVID cases than any nation in the world in recent days due to the spread of the Delta variant. On Sunday, Indonesia logged over 44,700 new cases and over 1,000 fatalities in 24 hours. The country entered a lockdown on July the 10th. It says some curbs due to end on Tuesday might be extended. In neighboring Vietnam, COVID is also surging, prompting authorities to tighten social distancing measures from Monday in the capital, Hanoi. Meanwhile, concerns are growing as the number of COVID-19 infections among the Tokyo Olympic athletes is on the rise. Organizers of the Games reported 3 new cases on Sunday. There were also 10 new cases connected to the Olympics, including media contractors and other personnel. An International Olympic Committee member who had been inoculated against COVID-19 tested positive for the virus upon landing in Tokyo. Now, this shows that the high infection risk, even from vaccinated attendees, infection rates are climbing among the general population of the capital, topping 1,000 new cases for 4 consecutive days. Polls show that many Japanese oppose holding the games with the influx of overseas visitors it entails. Clashes have erupted between Thai police and protesters angry at the government's handling of the coronavirus outbreak there.
I understand that the COVID situation is not getting any better, but you have to come out and show them that you are not happy about the measures imposed by the government. It's like they only wanted everything to stop at a standstill, but they were not trying to fix anything.
Police fired water cannons and tear gas to disperse protesters in Bangkok. Demonstrators were marching on the office of Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha. They called on him to step down. More than 1,000 people took part in the rally, despite an expanded coronavirus lockdown. They believe the government has acted poorly in managing the situation. Thailand has recently seen a rise in COVID cases. The surge is blamed on the highly contagious Delta variant that was first identified in India. Rescue workers are still searching for survivors in parts of northwestern Europe after rain-triggered floods caused rivers to burst and houses to collapse there. Days of extreme rainfall in Germany and Belgium has so far claimed the lives of 183 people. With many still missing, the death toll could rise further. In many areas, rescue efforts have been called off, and the focus has now shifted to the cleaning operation. The scale of the damage is becoming clear as the waters begin to recede and crews clear the streets of debris. Efforts are also underway to restore gas, electricity, and telephone services. European leaders have blamed climate change for the worst floods in decades. Switzerland, Luxembourg, and the Netherlands have also been affected. Jerome Hughes says recent floods have created an appalling situation in terms of human and financial losses.
And it's a very complex situation because as the death toll rises, and unfortunately we have a situation whereby the emergency services are finding bodies in, you know, houses, apartments, and even vehicles as well that have been swept away by the waters. And it's a tragic situation. Apart from the terrible burden on the families of those who have been lost, you also have a situation whereby we're talking here about billions of euro worth of damage. I mean, these are entire communities that have been washed away. It's an appalling situation, both, you know, in terms of human loss, but also financially. And, you know, of course, when we look at the reasons behind this, of course, climate change is being talked about. But also there's a lot of criticism, Behrouz, around planning, because these communities have been built on wetlands and floodplains. And actually now there's a big focus now on why are these communities being built on in these type of areas, because actually they're not suitable to have communities, to have villages, to have towns.
And with that brings us to the end of this World News Bulletin. Thank you all so much for joining us.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illa
I invite you to listen to a short part of the book Sirr al-Salat, The Secret of Prayer, written by Imam Khomeini. some discipline and secrets of takbirs, and the eradication of hands. Think about the reality of these holy praising, in which there are the doors of mystics, and within there is the discipline of being at the presence after purification and permission of Allah to enter and to be at His presence and purification of His sacred stage of description. Eradicate the sixth veil and call takbir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another saying of Imam Khomeini. In one of his sayings, Imam Khomeini has said that Islam is at the service of downtrodden. The people who have been oppressed through the times, the people who were downtrodden, who were treated badly by the people in the power, the people who were oppressed by the oppressors. You can see in the text of the Quran, for example, when it is the month of Ramadan, if someone breaks his fast intentionally, Islam says that now there is a fine on you. And the fine is you must free a slave. When a person is being killed unintentionally by anyone, Islam says yes. فَكُّ رَقَبَةً or تَحْرِيرُ الرَّقَبَةً. You need to free a slave. You need to free a slave. And Islam talks about the equality. It talks about the justice. Islam gives the lesson of justice.
يَا حَيُّ يَا قَيُّمُ يَا حَيُّ يَا قَيُّمُ يَا حَيُّ يَا قَيُّمُ يَا حَيُّ يَا قَيُّمُ.
In the ethics and in the traits of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we can see he used to sit with the servants, with his servants, and he used to eat with them on one table. Islam has come to serve such people. It has come to support such people. It has come to finish the different classes of the society and make them one. Therefore, we can see then it is the time of the prayers, when the people, the Muslims, they are standing in prayer, they all stand in one line. In that single line, there is a slave, there is a rich person, there is a person from middle class, there is a person from lower class. When they all stand in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when they're praying, when they're worshipping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, there is no difference amongst them. They all are in one line. And that's what Islam is all about, inshallah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
The United Arab Emirates is among a group of Arab states that have normalized ties with the Israeli regime as part of a controversial initiative brokered by the United States and condemned by Palestinians. The Emiratis, who have been particularly open about their ongoing normalization process, opened an embassy in Israel this week.
The UAE has never been known for having an independent foreign policy. It has never stood for the rights of Palestinian people. Historically and recently, as you have seen, the UAE has always aligned its foreign policy with the foreign policy objectives of Western countries like the US and UK.
The new embassy is located in the heart of Israel's financial hub, Tel Aviv's Stock Exchange building. This is seen by many as a sign that the two sides are highlighting the role of economic cooperation in their normalization of ties. Last month, Israel opened an embassy in the Emirati capital, Abu Dhabi, and a consulate in the UAE's business hub, Dubai. Over the past year, the two sides have signed many deals, ranging from financial services to tourism. Critics say Emirati leaders have totally abandoned the Palestinian cause for the economic and political dividends of ties with the Israeli regime. The controversial normalization process is very much ongoing, despite Palestinian anger. Palestinians are outraged by the normalization, which they believe is threatening their planned statehood. The stances adopted by these Arab governments seem to be helping the Israeli regime to move out of deep isolation in the West Asia region. Palestinians say those Arab states are stabbing them in the back. Palestinian movement Hamas says this week's embassy opening, quote, marks an insistence on the great sin against the people of Palestine and all the nations of the region. It warned that the move would encourage the regime to press ahead with its crimes in the occupied territories and in the besieged Gaza Strip. Observers warn that the embassy opening, just weeks after Israel's deadly onslaught against the Gaza Strip and the escalation of the regime's violations in the occupied West Bank, indicates that some Arab states are no longer bound by the Palestinian cause. Palestinians have been fighting an uphill battle against the Israeli occupation for decades. Things are perhaps tougher today, as several Arab states are undermining the Palestinian cause by moving closer to Israel. The Palestinian issue was once a unifying cause among Arab countries. But Israel, backed by the United States, has apparently managed to divide them more than ever. Israel has been especially thankful to the United States for pushing the UAE, Bahrain, Morocco, and Sudan to normalize their ties with the regime. America has always been a staunch ally of Israel. But former U.S. President Donald Trump was perhaps the best friend of the Israelis in a very long time. His extremely pro-Israel decisions and policies are still impacting the lives of people in the West Asia region, especially those in Palestine. The Palestinians say they have come to the conclusion that America's heavily biased stance leaves no room for any further U.S. mediation role regarding Palestine in the future.
As protests continue in Cuba, Iran has warned against any foreign interference in its internal affairs. Tehran has urged an end to Washington's unilateral sanctions on the Caribbean nation. The Iranian Foreign Ministry also highlighted the economic hardships caused by decades of U.S. measures against Cuba, especially during the COVID-19 pandemic. Iran says the U.S. is the root cause of many of the problems in Cuba. In a blatant violation of international law, Washington continues to express support for protests in Cuba and seeks to meddle in its affairs. Meanwhile, the Cuban Foreign Minister, Bruno Rodriguez, has held the U.S. responsible for stirring up violence in Cuba, saying that Washington is using high-tech digital systems to incite protests in the Caribbean island nation. Rodriguez has said that Washington sought to generate disorder and instability to fracture the constitutional order and social consensus in Cuba. He condemned the campaign promoted from U.S. soil through social media to promote riots and destabilizing acts, warning that such irresponsible conduct could have negative implications for the region and even harm the national interests of the U.S.
The United States has, since the 60s, been interfering in the internal affairs of Cuba. Beginning with the Bay of Pigs, they launched not only an invasion of Cuba, but also tried to create paramilitaries there. And in doing so, they also set up a blockade, which affected the internal and the domestic economy of Cuba and had a long-lasting impact for over six decades, costing hundreds of billions of dollars.
A large-scale anti-Cuba communication operation had been underway since June 23, when Havana presented the report, Necessity of Ending the Economic, Commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the United States of America on Cuba at the UN General Assembly. The operation includes calls for violence, aggression against authorities, and the assassination of leaders.
A lot of these attempts have ended up failing, but these are all attempts to really strangle the nation and strangle really the civilians. And it's very hypocritical of the United States, who's now decrying interference from foreign countries like Russia or China, to have this history with interfering with other nations like Cuba, but also outside of Cuba throughout Latin America.
Protest rallies erupted against the Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel's government over the weekend. Thousands took to the streets in major cities, demanding his resignation amid a worsening economic crisis. The unrest comes at a time when Cuba is going through its worst economic crisis in 30 years, with chronic shortages of electricity and food, exacerbated by hefty U.S. sanctions.
There are difficult times due to circumstances, including the blockade, including the pandemic, which is already causing difficulty on the island for many of the people. And the U.S. is continuing to add to that difficulty by continuing these illegal sanctions. And again, it's not just the case for Cuba. We can go to Venezuela.
The Cuban government blames the economic woes mainly on U.S. sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic. The U.S. has maintained a harsh economic, financial, and commercial embargo against Cuba for more than 60 years. Numerous resolutions by the U.N. General Assembly have indicated that the blockade is against international law. The social media campaign directed against Cuba is reminiscent of many other regime change programs directed by the U.S.
It was just recently that the U.N. voted against the U.N. U.S. embargo, with only two countries voting against that resolution. That was the U.S. and Israel, while over 180 countries voted to end the illegal embargo or blockade against Cuba. Yet, despite these votes, which have been occurring, you know, every few years or so, the U.S. continues with this blockade,
including the 2019 coup d'etat against the Bolivian President Evo Morales and an attempted coup against President Maduro in Venezuela. The U.S. has recently further tightened the illegal embargo under the pretext of fighting the spread of the coronavirus. Many Cubans have grown frustrated with the economic crisis and the surge in coronavirus cases. Although the current U.S. President Joe Biden had pledged during his presidential campaign to reverse some of Trump's brutal sanctions measured against Cuba, he has yet to remove any of the sanctions imposed by the former Republican president.
It all started in November 2017 when Saudi forces detained dozens of royals and business people and imprisoned them inside the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Riyadh under the pretext of an anti-corruption drive ordered by the newly appointed Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, also known as MBS. He has gone to great lengths to consolidate power and eliminate potential rivals ever since. On March 6, 2020, Mohammed bin Nayef, Saudi Arabia's former crown prince, was detained on the charge of treason. Saad al-Jabri, a former Saudi spymaster and bin Nayef's longtime aide, is the latest high-profile figure caught in the heated rivalry. Jabri alleged in a lawsuit last year that MBS sent a, quote, tiger squad to assassinate him in Canada, where he lives in exile. He also said the crown prince detained his two children to pressure him to go back home. Two lawsuits filed by Saudi state-run companies are accusing Jabri of embezzlement. The firms are part of a network providing cover for clandestine operations with the U.S. Court documents show Jabri intends to make revelations that include matters related to, quote, U.S. national security activities, raising concerns inside Washington and prompting the U.S. to consider a rare judicial intervention.
When it was revealed that the Crown Prince had sent his assassin's squads to Canada to assassinate one of his former security aides, people just became more alarmed that another repeat of the Khashoggi drama was unfolding. And it is not a joke, these threats to assassinate opposition figures by some Gulf countries is a very serious business.
Jamal Khashoggi was a Saudi dissident journalist who was killed and dismembered at the kingdom's embassy in Istanbul in October 2018. From Yemen to Istanbul, Saudi Arabia has left a trail of bodies behind. But that's not to say it doesn't target its people within the confines of its borders.
The Saudis have always had a bleak record on human rights. Their record is simply black. They arrest the people for expressing their opinion. They kill, they behead and crucify opponents for the smallest of things, for criticizing the regime, for asking to improve their own lives.
As MBS kicked off his campaign of crackdown on dissent, he announced a series of social reforms, including the so-called women's rights reforms, lifting bans on driving and travel restrictions. Amid all the fanfare, however, the kingdom launched a tougher crackdown on women's rights activists, raising questions about Riyadh's intentions in announcing the reforms. Just weeks before the Saudi government lifted the ban on women's driving, Lujain Al-Hathloul, an activist who campaigned for women's driving rights, was detained. A prison guard working in a Dahban central prison has given an account of how female prisoners, including Al-Hathloul, were and are being tortured. The guard has said that inmates are subjected to violent treatments, including electric shocks, beatings, whippings, and sexual assaults.
This treatment amounts to crimes against humanity. They are considered crimes of humanity, against humanity, whether it is torture, whether it is arbitrary detention, whether it is extrajudicial killing.
U.S. President Joe Biden vowed earlier this year to press Saudi Arabia over its rights records, but later decided not to penalize the kingdom for assassinating Khashoggi. If the violators of human rights aren't held accountable, doesn't that embolden them to think they can carry on and get away with murder in its most literal sense?
The Mujahideen Khalq group sided with the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein when the Ba'athist regime attacked Iran in 1980. The group claims to have fought for the Iranian people, yet it has the blood of thousands of Iranian civilians on its hands. This year, the annual three-day meeting of the MKO terrorist group is hosted by Albania. The group gathers hired supporters among several former and current American and European officials to deliver paid speeches. This year, several high-profile Western politicians, including Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša, a number of U.S. lawmakers, as well as former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, are among invitees. Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša also delivered a speech at the conference that drew harsh criticism from Iran and promoted the Iranian Foreign Ministry to summon the Slovenian ambassador to Tehran. In a statement on Sunday, the ministry slammed the Slovenian Prime Minister's move as unacceptable and undiplomatic. Angered by the participation of Iranians in the June presidential election, Pompeo claimed that the vote was a boycott.
The program of sanctions and pressure employed by the Trump administration needs to remain the model for engagement with Iran if we want to ensure the security of the American people and better lives for the Iranian people. In Washington, D.C., there is much consensus, as evidenced by the overwhelming support for the sanctions regime that we put into place.
In response, the Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman said the MKO is a terrorist cult having the blood of Iranian people on its hands. Saeed Khatibzadeh denounced Western politicians, including Pompeo, for selling themselves cheap to the Europe-hosted circus. He also accused the West of shameful hypocrisy driven by an insatiable thirst for money and anti-Iran obsession.
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the MKO is being supported by the Western countries because it is essentially carrying out imperialist interests. Obviously, the MKO is right there in design in order to overthrow the Iranian government and place some kind of cult activity inside the country. I mean, it's very clear that they're being used as a proxy force to fight the Iranian government.
Iran has always complained that the West's support for a terrorist group such as MKO violates the UN Charter and international norms. The Mujahideen Khalq organization has conducted numerous assassinations and bombings against Iranian statesmen and civilians since the 1979 victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution. Out of the nearly 17,000 Iranians killed in different terrorist attacks over the past four decades, about 12,000 of them have fallen victim to the MKO. MKO's rift with Iran worsened when its leader, Masoud Rajavi, aligned with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the eight-year Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s. MKO received funding, weapons, ammunition, vehicles, and the use of land in exchange for its support for Saddam. Despite all the crimes committed by the MKO, it is not currently listed by any Western country as a terrorist organization. The European Union and the US, that often claim to be anti-terrorism, rather removed the MKO from their lists of terror organizations in 2009 and 2012 respectively. Ever since, the West has changed its stance toward the MKO, propagating it not only as an opposition group, but misses no chance to fund the group and lobby in its favor by putting a blind eye to how the MKO spilled the blood of innocent people.
So this is a long-standing policy by the United States, and it shows that the U.S. is not interested in fighting terrorism whatsoever. They're very fond of being able to use terrorists to their own ends, to carry out their own means whenever it's in their interest to do so.
The West's support for the hated MKO group has added to a more feeling of distrust among Iranians toward the Western governments. West support for a terrorist cult only exposes their double standards when it comes to terrorist organizations.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters. You are listening to The Lantern here on IRIB English Radio. It is not ethical, Islamically speaking, to be in a gathering where someone we know is being spoken ill of behind their back and for us not to defend them. What do I mean by this? Let's listen to an actual anecdote, an actual story, so maybe that would probably help us wrap our minds around this concept better, and we're going to be right back.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear brothers and sisters, dear friends of this program, Lantern, so welcome. We have an interesting story for today, so let's see what's the title. Being loyal to those not present. Being loyal to those not present is one of the most difficult of all the deposits. It is one of the highest tests of both character and the depth of bonding that has taken place in a relationship. This is particularly the case when everyone seems to be joining in on bad-mouthing and piling on someone who is not present. you can just speak up and say, I see it differently. Or, my experience is different. Or, you may have a point, let's go talk to him or her about it. By doing so, you instantly communicate that integrity is loyalty, not just to those absent, but also to those who are present. All the people present will inwardly admire and respect you. I remember heading up a meeting in a large organization where the formal leaders were discussing various personnel issues. They seemed to be in complete agreement regarding the weakness of a particular individual. They even began to tell jokes and funny stories about this individual in ways they would never do to the person's face. Later, the same day, one of the executives came to me and said that for the first time he could now trust my expressions of appreciation and affection for him. Why so? I asked. He replied, because when we were cutting that person in our earlier meeting, you went against the current and showed genuine concern, care, and regard for them. I asked why that had impacted him. He said, because I have similar weakness, only they're worse. No one knows about them, not even you. So every time you've expressed your appreciation and regard for me inwardly, I've said, but you don't understand. Today I feel you would. I feel you would be true and loyal to me even in my absence, and that I can trust you and believe your kind expressions. Yes, the key to the many is often the one. It is how you regard and talk about the one in the one's absence and presence that communicates to the many how you would regard and talk about them in their presence or absence. Thank you for joining us. Now we'll listen to the continuation of this episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. Author of this story was Stefan R. Covey.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Defending a fellow brother or sister in their presence goes much, much more beyond just sticking up for a friend, which is actually one of the rights of a friend. The hadith tells us that the rights of your brother in faith or your friend, your buddy, your companion are a few things. One of it is for you to defend them in their absence, right? If you feel that someone is usurping their right while they're not around, someone is trespassing upon their right, violating their rights, taking something of theirs, or whether it's a position or a possession or a promotion at the office, you know that your friend was deserving of it. There's a board meeting and they weren't there, and someone else is trying to butter up the boss to take the position. You stand up for that absent friend and you tell them in a civil, well-mannered, amiable way, in a respectable way, that with all due respect to those present, I feel that John or Qasim or Khadija is a better candidate, is more eligible for this position for this and this and this reason, not just because they're my buddy. Defend them in a useful way. So not only is it about that person who's absent, that friend who's absent, it's about you, it's about me. It's about everyone. It's about people being reminded that backbiting is one of the most heinous, most disturbing, and detested sins in Islam. It's worse than zina. Ashaddu min al-zina. It's worse than adultery. It's worse than fornication. And we forget that so often. So often do we forget that. And also it's like eating the carcass. Eating the carcass of a fellow, of another human being, of your brother. I mean, since when did we turn into zombies like that? So we remind others that it's not cool. We save them from the wrath of Allah by reminding them that y'all gotta stop whatever it is that you're doing, talking about another human being's, talking behind another human being's back is against all the values of Islam, number one. Number two, I demand to be respected. Well, don't say it exactly in those words because then they're going to feel you're full of yourself and it defeats the objective of being ethical and moral. But basically, the idea is that I demand to be respected in a way that in my presence, no one commits such sins and no one talks about my friend that way. And my friend deserves to be defended. In their defense, perhaps there was a misunderstanding. In their defense, perhaps they were having a bad day that day. And it will inspire others. It will give them courage to speak against such oppressions and transgressions when other opportunities present themselves. It's a form of amr bil ma'ruf wa nahi anil munkar. It's a form of enjoining the good and forbidding the bad. So basically, so many virtues and benefits come through the simple act of defending a person who's been spoken about in an ill manner in their absence. Or defending someone who's absent, basically, and whatever rights of theirs is being trampled upon. Doing ghibah of someone is a form of oppression, is it not? Their right is being taken from them because they're not there to defend themselves and tell it as it is, tell their version of the story. So the point is that every teaching in Islam is more than bigger than just me, my benefit, their benefit, heaven and hell. It has a deep, comprehensive, inclusive philosophy to it, and we will understand it better. The better we understand it, the better we can practice it. The more we practice it, the more we will be reviving such Islamic values. Thank you for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah.
Ala bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu al-qulub.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.